Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, Ashley Thompson and I report on a city in Indonesia that recently began enforcing a new regulation that bars women from working after 11 o'clock at night. The regulation has produced mixed reactions among Indonesians. The law has received international attention. The law is in effect in Banda Aceh, the capital of Aceh Province. Aceh is the westernmost province in Indonesia. It is on the island of Sumatra.
Eliza Saaduddin Jamal is the mayor of Banda Aceh. She is the city's first female mayor. Ms. Jamal says the Aceh Provincial Administration approved the law in early June. She says she later made a few changes based on the situations and conditions in Banda Aceh.
The law is directed at women who work in what officials are calling recreational areas, such as internet cafes, coffee shops, and sports centers. The mayor says the measure orders business owners to not let women work after 11 p.m. Ms. Jamal says the purpose of the law is to protect female workers. She says it is dangerous for women to work in recreational areas late at night. She says the rule aims to prevent sexual violence against women. The mayor says business owners, not their female employees, will be punished for violating the law. She adds that the Banda Aceh administration might revoke a business's permit to operate if it violates the law.
Ms. Jamal says the rule does not extend to women who work as politicians, journalists, medical aides, or hotel employees. VOA spoke to the mayor by telephone. She denies that the law bars women from being outside the home after 11 p.m.
I myself sometimes have to work until dawn. I am a woman myself. There is no way that I would harm women. Banda Aceh is a women-friendly city, and we will be fighting for women's rights.
Indonesia is the largest Muslim-majority country in the world. Of Indonesia's 34 provinces, Aceh is the only one enforcing its form of Islamic or Sharia law. For years, the area struggled during a long, bloody civil war. In 2006, a tsunami hit Aceh province, claiming thousands of lives. 10 years ago, the central government decided to give the provincial administration permission to enact Sharia law. The offer was part of a peace deal to end the fighting. The Aceh administration has approved rules that require both Muslims and non-Muslims to obey Sharia law. The rules bar people from drinking alcohol and gambling, playing games of chance. They also bar people from ignoring Friday prayers and from physical contact between the sexes outside of marriage.
The administration also requires women to cover their heads. Women are not permitted to wear tight pants. In some parts of Aceh, women cannot dance in public or ride motorcycles with men who are not family members. The provincial administration has deployed special police officers to enforce the Sharia laws. Caning is one possible punishment for violators. Activists say such laws discriminate against women. Azriana, who like many Indonesians has only one name, is chair of Indonesia's National Commission on Violence Against Women.
This is a discriminatory law because it restricts women's spaces. It does not impose on men.
She says the new law is unnecessary because Aceh's labor laws already control operating hours for businesses.
If the mayor says that the number of cases of sexual violence is high, the problem is in men's minds, not the women's. So restricting women's spaces is not the answer to this problem.
Ellie lives in Aceh province. She says she used to live in the city of Banda Aceh for almost 10 years.
This is unfair. How about the domestic violence cases? Restricting women to not go outside after 11 p.m. does not guarantee that this new law would lower the number of cases of domestic violence.
She says some women might only be able to work at night.
If a woman is the backbone of the family, this law will restrict her working hours. As a result, this might also affect her income to support her family. How about the men who sometimes hang out at coffee houses until 2 a.m.? The men have wives and children, but they still hang out during those hours.
The Aceh Monitoring Network is a group of non-governmental organizations. The network fights for the empowerment of women and to protect children. The group says there were 581 cases of sexual violence against women across Aceh between 2013 and 2014. About 66% of the cases were said to be domestic violence cases. The attacks took place at home and involved family members. Ms. Ellie suggests the local administration increase security in Banda Aceh. She says the local administration should protect both sexes, not only women. And she thinks the administration should have a better way to protect the public at night, without restricting the movement of women. To prevent domestic violence, Ms. Ellie adds, the administration should educate both men and women to treat women with more respect.
This law is not the answer to tackling the sexual violence issues.
Ms. Azriana says better education will also make people understand that women are not sexual objects.
Moreover, the local administration has to bring the perpetrators of domestic and sexual violence to justice.
The new law has also fueled debate among Indonesian governmental officials. Yusuf Kalla is the country's vice president. The Indonesian newspaper Kompas reported that Mr. Kalla questioned the urgency of implementing the law. He called on the Aceh administration to re-examine the regulation.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
from VOA Learning English. This is In the News. The United States and Cuba will reestablish diplomatic relations and, later this month, will reopen embassies in Washington and Havana. President Barack Obama made the announcement on Wednesday. The decision is part of efforts to end years of conflicts between the two countries. The tensions began shortly after Fidel Castro overthrew the Cuban government in 1959. 2 years later, the United States ended relations with Cuba. And in 1962, it put in place an embargo, a complete end to trade. In December, Mr. Obama and Cuban dictator Raúl Castro announced the two countries had agreed to reestablish diplomatic relations. Secret meetings had been taking place between representatives of the two countries since 2013. The two men met in April in Panama at the Summit of the Americas. And in May, the United States removed Cuba from its list of state supporters of terrorism. Commercial air and ferry services between the two countries have been or are being restored. Restrictions on communications have been eased. American citizens may travel to Cuba, although there are limits on the reasons for their travel. But there are still issues the two countries must resolve. For example, it is still not legal for American products to be shipped to Cuba. However, President Obama has called for the trade embargo to be ended. And the United States believes Cuba must improve its human rights record. Last month, the United States released its yearly human rights report. It said Cuba does not respect basic freedoms. It said the Cuban government detains political opponents for no reason and limits its citizens' ability to read independent information free of censorship. President Obama's efforts to ease tensions between the two countries are not popular with his political opponents in Congress. Many Republican lawmakers say he is ignoring Cuba's poor human rights record. The House and Senate, which are controlled by Republicans, could refuse to approve money to open an American embassy in Havana. They could block whoever Mr. Obama names as the new American ambassador to Cuba. Experts also say Congress is not likely to agree to end the economic embargo on Cuba. Ileana Ross-Leitanen is a Republican member of the House of Representatives from the southern state of Florida, which is just 144 kilometers from Cuba. She is also a Cuban American. She represents many Cuban refugees. On Tuesday, she released a statement that said a new U.S. embassy in Cuba will, in her words, do nothing to help the Cuban people. She said President Obama made the decision to improve relations with Cuba only because he wanted future historians to think well of him. Nancy Pelosi is the top Democrat in the House of Representatives and a former Speaker of the House. She said the decision will help American businesses and families. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Our story today is called The Diamond Lens. It was written by Fitzjames O'Brien. We will tell the story in two parts. Now, here is Morris Joyce with part one of The Diamond Lens.
When I was 10 years old, one of my older cousins gave me a microscope. The first time I looked through its magic lens, the clouds that surrounded my daily life rolled away. I saw a universe of tiny living creatures in a drop of water. Day after day, night after night, I studied life under my microscope. The fungus that spoiled my mother's jam was, for me, a land of magic gardens. I would put one of those spots of green mold under my microscope and see beautiful forests where strange silver and golden fruit hung from the branches of tiny trees. I felt as if I had discovered another Garden of Eden. Although I didn't tell anyone about my secret world, I decided to spend my life studying the microscope. My parents had other plans for me. When I was nearly 20 years old, they insisted that I learn a profession. Even though we were a rich family, and I really didn't have to work at all, I decided to study medicine in New York. This city was far away from my family, so I could spend my time as I pleased, as long as I paid my medical school fees every year. My family would never know I wasn't attending any classes. In New York, I would be able to buy excellent microscopes and meet scientists from all over the world. I would have plenty of money and plenty of time to spend on my dream. I left home with high hopes. 2 days after I arrived in New York, I found a place to live. It was large enough for me to use one of the rooms as my laboratory. I filled this room with expensive scientific equipment that I did not know how to use. But by the end of my first year in the city, I had become an expert with the microscope. I also had become more and more unhappy. The lens in my expensive microscope was still not strong enough to answer my questions about life. I imagined there were still secrets in nature that the limited power of my equipment prevented me from knowing. I lay awake nights, wishing to find the perfect lens, an instrument of great magnifying power. Such a lens would permit me to see life in the smallest parts of its development. I was sure that a powerful lens like that could be built, and I spent my second year in New York trying to create it. I experimented with every kind of material. I tried simple glass, crystal, and even precious stones, but I always found myself back where I started. My parents were angry at the lack of progress in my medical studies. I had not gone to one class since arriving in New York. Also, I had spent a lot of money on my experiments. One day, while I was working in my laboratory, Jules Simon knocked at my door. He lived in the apartment just above mine. I knew he loved jewelry, expensive clothing, and good living. There was something mysterious about him, too. He always had something to sell, a painting, a rare statue, an expensive pair of lamps. I never understood why Simon did this. He didn't seem to need the money. He had many friends among the best families of New York. Simon was very excited as he came into my laboratory. "Oh, my dear fellow," he gasped, "I have just seen the most amazing thing in the world." He told me he had gone to visit a woman who had strange, magical powers. She could speak to the dead and read the minds of the living. To test her, Simon had written some questions about himself on a piece of paper. The woman, Madame Vulpes, had answered all of the questions correctly. Hearing about this woman gave me an idea. Perhaps she would be able to help me discover the secret of the perfect lens. 2 days later, I went to her house. Madame Vulpes was an ugly woman with sharp, cruel eyes. She didn't say a word to me when she opened the door, but took me right into her living room. We sat down at a large, round table, and she spoke. "What do you want from me?" "I want to speak to a person who died many years before I was born." "Put your hands on the table." We sat there for several minutes. The room grew darker and darker, but Madame Vulpes did not turn on any lights. I began to feel a little silly. Then I felt a series of violent knocks. They shook the table, the back of my chair, the floor under my feet, and even the windows. Madame Vulpes smiled. "They are very strong tonight. You are lucky. They want you to write down the name of the spirit you wish to talk to." I tore a piece of paper out of my notebook and wrote down a name. I didn't show it to Madame Vulpes. After a moment, Madame Vulpes' hand began to shake so hard the table moved. She said a spirit was now holding her hand and would write me a message. I gave her paper and a pencil. She wrote something and gave the paper to me. The message read, "I am here. Question me." It was signed Leeuwenhoek. I couldn't believe my eyes. The name was the same one I had written on my piece of paper. I was sure that an ignorant woman like Madame Vulpes would not know who Leeuwenhoek was. Why would she know the name of the man who invented the microscope? Quickly, I wrote a question on another piece of paper. "How can I create the perfect lens?" Leeuwenhoek wrote back, "Find a diamond of 140 carats. Give it a strong electrical charge. The electricity will change the diamond's atoms. From that stone, you can form the perfect lens." I left Madame Vulpes' house in a state of painful excitement. Where would I find a diamond that large? All my family's money could not buy a diamond like that, and even if I had enough money, I knew that such diamonds are very difficult to find. When I came home, I saw a light in Simon's window. I climbed the stairs to his apartment and went in without knocking. Simon's back was toward me as he bent over a lamp. He looked as if he were carefully studying a small object in his hands. As soon as he heard me enter, he put the object in his pocket. His face became red, and he seemed very nervous. "What are you looking at?" I asked. Simon didn't answer me. Instead, he laughed nervously and told me to sit down. I couldn't wait to tell him my news. "Simon, I have just come from Madame Volpe's. She gave me some important information that will help me find the perfect lens. If only I could find a diamond that weighs 140 carats. My words seemed to change Simon into a wild animal. He rushed to a small table and grabbed a long, thin knife. "No," he shouted, "you won't get my treasure. I'll die before I give it to you." "My dear Simon," I said, "I don't know what you are talking about. I went to Madame Volpe's to ask her for help with a scientific problem. She told me I needed an enormous diamond. You could not possibly own a diamond that large. If you did, you would be very rich, and you wouldn't be living here." He stared at me for a second, and then he laughed and apologized. "Simon," I suggested, "let us drink some wine and forget all this. I have two bottles downstairs in my apartment. What do you think?" "I like your idea," he said. I brought the wine to his apartment, and we began to drink. By the time we had finished the first bottle, Simon was very sleepy and very drunk. I felt as calm as ever, for I believed that I knew Simon's secret.
You have just heard part one of The Diamond Lens by Fitzjames O'Brien. It was adapted for Special English by Donna DeSanctis. Your storyteller was Morris Joyce. Listen again next week for the final part of our story told in Special English on The Voice of America. This is Shirley Griffith.